on an effective and ethical public sector in terms of the principles and values enshrined in the constitution. So we're working in that regard, also partnering with the Public Service Commission to guide in terms of these Section 195. Then we also talk of, if I then come to integrated planning and coordination, we have pulled in the public works, all the units within the public works, working together with all the provincial departments within public works. But beyond that, in terms of all the spheres of government, which is guided by the accounting office of the department with the HODs of the provinces, with SALGA and COPTA and the CEOs and the chairpersons of the entities, and then also the MINMEC, which is chaired by the Minister of Public Works with the MECs and the technical MINMEC members. So this is also a drive towards a single understanding of what constitutes this public work sector in managing the issues of the sector, in managing the asset register, in managing the debt, and managing GBV issues, etc. So those are some of the issues that are now contained in that, so that we all move into that. Now, linked to that is also the support and the development of standard operating procedures in contributing to the district development model, which is led by COPTA. So we are also contributing to that in that. And our minister and deputy ministers are champions in various districts in this regard. Also part of the integrated planning coordination, now linked to sustainable infrastructure outcome, is the development of the National Infrastructure Plan 5050, which has already been gazetted. Now, the context of this is so that we have an understanding of the infrastructure for the country and public works as a single entry point of infrastructure, and understanding all of this is also to have an infrastructure pipeline and bring about certainty in terms of our infrastructure as part of our deliberate move towards attracting investors within the infrastructure space. And this links directly with the vision of the department, the impact statement that says infrastructure-led growth, where we strongly believe that the infrastructure can serve can contribute to growth, and then the spin-offs from driving the infrastructure will also improve growth, unemployment, as well as inequality measures that we face in the country, challenges that we face in the country. Then also, as part of that, you've seen that I think also part of the presentation that was done by the minister as well in terms of the budget speech, there were some projects that have actually been moved, that are now at an implementation stages. Some of them have reached financial closure and others have been completed. And that also shows the extent and the speed to which we are moving in driving the infrastructure in the country. And then also part of this is also the funding of this, as I alluded to the issue of certainty, is also working together with National Treasury and other financial bodies such as DBSA on how to then look at funding these infrastructure projects, as well as managing those infrastructures and we deliver on those infrastructure projects. Now, we also, as part of contributing to the economic recovery and reconstruction plan, there are quite a number of initiatives in the department. These are also partly talking about the productive assets. How do we use our own assets to also contribute to the recovery of the country? Now, we are working with CIDB, where we have developed a construction recovery plan that then seeks to revive construction, which has been on the downward trend since 2009. But you'll also see that the component of our construction project management in relation to the, its targets and achievements, you will see that there's quite a number of challenges, external factors contributing to that. some which are basically the misinterpretation and the abuse of the interpretation of the 30%, which has also resulted in also the construction mafias as external forces that also are affecting the changes and the and the operations at the, on the ground with regards to infrastructure or construction per se. So these are some of the issues that we are working on, that construction recovery plan, where we are focusing largely on three main things. One is to look at how do we revive the economy through e-construction, where we are looking at backward and forward linkages and also the role players in within that infrastructure and that construction sector. The second aspect is to look at how do we then also empower SMMEs within the construction sector. And then the third component is to look at how do we also promote local content within the construction as a full suite of how we are contributing to that. Now, the other aspect that we are also contributing is also tapping into the skills of the unemployed graduates. And this is through our professional services branch, where they are looking at a pool of unemployed graduates, where they are also now putting and also mapping them and assigning them in different programs within the department, where they can also contribute as part of contributing to youth unemployment and also tapping into the unemployed graduates. So we're also looking at in that context. And then also EPWP through work opportunities to some degree also contribute to economic recovery, particularly on looking at those temporary work opportunities that can also provide relief, be it social relief, and in the form of stipend and also exposure and experience that can be gained from some of the projects. So it's also contributing to that in the recovery. Now, that also touches on productive assets. And as part of the skills pipeline and tapping into the youth, putting them into the built environment, we are also focusing on how we are transforming the built environment in the sector as well. We also have land reform initiatives, Chairperson and members of the committee. And this also talks to two things. One is the integrated planning and coordination, but also talking to the other outcome of productive assets. In the context that how do we leverage on our land and integrate our plans with other government departments, particularly those that are also the custodian of land, such as your rural development, and contributing to assisting and coordinating our efforts to driving the issues of land reform. And you'll see that we also have a total of about 20,000 hectares of land that were released for socio-economic imperatives. One, to rural development for agricultural purposes, and also to human settlements for human settlement development. And those are some of the initiatives that we are looking at in terms of how we also, as government as a whole, we integrate our plans and coordinate and have a voice, in a common voice, on the outcome and the impact as government in relation to giving effect to land reform initiatives. And also using our facilities as part of productive assets, particularly when we're looking at unutilized facilities. We are doing two things when it comes to GPVF. GPVF, we are contributing also to the National Strategic Plan of GPVF under the President's, especially the Department of Women, Persons with Disabilities and Youth. So we are also contributing to the pillars of empowerment, pillars of protection, as well as pillars of ensuring that women also form part of the mainstream economic activities and are not left behind, as also contributing to some of the SDGs, sustainable development goals, in giving effect to that. So we have two things that we're doing. On the one hand is advocacy, using our facilities in terms of advocacy through billboards, where we showcase and also provide information about GPVF and its impact on the ground. On the second one is where we are working with the Department of Social Development, where we then provide those facilities to shelter victims of GPVF, and also where I think some of the economic spin-offs and other initiatives can actually emanate from those facilities and interactions that will also link and contribute to the pillars that are also identified in the NSP GBVF. And then also, I think as part of integrated planning and coordination is also, we also, and through the sustainable infrastructure, through the SIPs, which is your structures as strategic integrated projects, we're also looking at one of the SIPs, which is the Welisizwe Bridges, working together with the KZN Department of Transport, where we also participated and intervened in KZN in providing support. And I think there was, at some stage, there was a clip that was doing rounds of kids trying to cross the bridge. And I think those are the kind of initiatives we are doing on how do you then link communities through these Welisizwe Bridges for them to be able to access some of the social and also economic nodes within their communities. And all of those, Chair and members, are linking to a dignified client experience to say we work with other government departments. We trigger a process of providing land so that other government departments can also assist in contributing to land reform. We work with client departments for them to be able to administer their function by providing efficient and sufficient and adequate facilities. And that also helps us to then look at how then do we see our client experiencing high levels of satisfaction through the initiatives of public works as well as the client department. And that is our dignified client experience, where we seek to deliver sustainable services and stakeholders are satisfied. Now, that's basically in the accounting officer, which is the high level, and to some degree, it's also explained by some indicators and targets linked to that. Now, in terms of performance overall, what we've done, our measure of performance here, we are looking at targets that have been achieved, and our assessment is we look at a program and say, how many targets does the program have, or indicators have, and then how many targets were actually achieved in that financial year. And then we then express it as a percentage, and then in terms of how many that is. So this then reflects the number, the quantum of targets that are achieved. And by achieved, we are focusing on a high level achievement range. In this case, we are not looking at a 25% interval. We are looking at 0 to 10 is target not achieved. 11 to 49 is target not achieved, which basically means that it's at an activity or initiation stages. Between 51 and 89%, it means that some outputs have been achieved, but some is still in the activity stage. And then 90% and above, this is where we say that's our high level of targets that have been achieved. So what we're reflecting here is 90% and above, all those targets that are sitting at 90% above. So you can actually see that administrative, which is a support function, is sitting at 50 in terms of the targets that have been achieved, and that's about 7 indicators, 6 indicators, 3 achieved, that gives us 50%. Then the others is program 2, intergovernmental coordination, and which has two programs, intergovernmental relations as well as professional services, where all their indicators have been achieved. Now, intergovernmental drives the outcome on integrated planning, which is the 5-sector plan. Then professional services, they are also driving the indicator on contributing to the economic recovery through tapping on the young professions as well as under unemployed graduates. Then we've got the expanded program works, which focuses largely on the work opportunities as well as and the breakdown of those work opportunities in relation to designated groups, people with disabilities, women, as well as youth. And then we have policy, where we've got a number of indicators, which are mostly legislative. And part of it, again, if you look at our outcomes, it's more on transforming the built environment. And we use one is legislative in terms of that. And this resonates with outcome or with the priority of government one, where you talk about the developmental state and how we use that regulatory machinery to then transform or change the status quo in various sectors. Unfortunately, there's quite a number of things that are still pending in relation to that. And this also speaks to expropriation as well as a number of policies that also needs to give effect to the built environment. Then prestige is basically the support that we provide to prestige portfolio which includes parliament as well as the presidency. So they achieved all their targets in provision, in the provision of infrastructure for either state events as well as the kind of support that we provide to parliamentary services. And then we also have real estate investment services, which basically is the financier or the investment analysis of the portfolio as a whole and how we can leverage or use that portfolio to drive the business of the sector or the business of the department, but also working with the government departments in terms of ensuring that all their needs are also captured as per the GIAMA in terms of the user requirements or user UMs, and then consolidate that into CMs, which is also a mandatory aspect in terms of GIAMA, Section 13 of GIAMA, to National Treasury. So they've also achieved that. But going beyond that is to then looking at how then do we continue and sustain that also dignified client experience, sustainable services to them based on those where we'll continue to have interactions with them. And they've established joint task teams to continuously have engagements with the clients on some of the challenges that they experience. Then CPM again links to the construction recovery, as we alluded earlier on, is sitting at 80% in terms of achievement of their targets. We're looking at also the level at which some of these issues needs to be relooked in relation to the challenges that they normally face, which I'll touch on in the next presentation. But they're sitting on 80% in terms of their targets. Real estate, the asset manager, the leasing portfolio. Quite a number of challenges that we are facing in the leasing portfolio, and I think also from the discussions and the challenges that I'll also express some of the challenges that we're currently facing. And I think because of the link between real estate and asset register is also the issues of understanding the quantum and the data within the asset register, and also in order for us to then make proper decisions on what then do we do with our assets or facilities for leasing. So I think there's also that kind of connection between REMS and RAIS in the context of the asset register. And then facilities management, and I think for some time it has been lagging. This is now sitting at 67%. If you look at the previous financial years, it's not been performing very well. But I think the change in the approach to actually putting the client at the center of the business and ensuring that there's level of satisfaction derived from the services we render, we're also looking at how to turn this to better improve that. So there are current discussions on critical matters that will then change this. Overall, when you look at this, we're sitting at 60% achievement of the targets, and this compares to the previous financial year where we're sitting at 62%. So yes, we can argue that is a slight decline if you compare, but if you look at individual indicators, you can actually see that there are some that have actually improved. Now, in terms of the details now, Program 1, which was sitting at 50%, we had challenges in terms of the SMS levels, and our target was more of pushing 50% women in SMS level and well as 2% for people with disabilities. And I think the challenge largely was around the 2%, reaching the 2% disabilities, because we did achieve the target for women. I think the challenge was more of the context and the nature of the work in the department, and looking at also the applicants, we're also finding that there's a challenge in terms of the applications that we receive to also look in the context of people with disabilities within the space of public works. Then in terms of this one of digitization and automation, it alluded to the point of resilient as well as a capable state, and looking at also ICT and ERP. These are some of the challenges where I think the procurement has commenced, but also the approval came a bit late in terms of National Treasury 2022. March, and then we are also looking at how best then to speed up this process. And also alluded to the fact that we have also appointed a chief information officer who's also driving this, because on Tuesdays they sit to fast track these processes with the relevant line functions, particularly those that have modules forming part of the ERP, to ensure that all the user requirements are catered for in driving this process going forward. Then program three, which was EPWP, I think I've explained that the issue was more on the youth and people with disabilities in terms of achieving those targets. And I think the indicators was impacted by a number of programs which were more focused on, the uptake was more on the women, but less interest from the youth. But I think also people with disabilities, one of the things that is that it has not been mainstreamed in such a way that those projects also cater for a large number of persons with disabilities. And I think that is the relook. They need to relook from the EPWP space, looking at how then do you reconsider or reconsider the structure of those programs, and to what extent they also accept and also provide for persons with disabilities. Construction, property construction and policy, which is program four, which I alluded to, not have achieved any targets, is that At the time when there was a service provider to have developed a memorandum of objects for the draft bill, it was also found that there were quite a number of challenges and issues that were not considered in the process, because this is a technical exercise of legal legislation issues, as well as aligning that to the object of why we are looking at public works bill. And that had a ripple effect in terms of parting ways with the service provider in terms of the financials, as well as ensuring that the groundwork is also done in terms of the objects of the act, as well as the legal drafting of this. But significant work has actually, to date, there's quite a number of work has actually been put in, efforts has been put in to try and speed up this process. And I think there's significant discussions that have actually propelled this process forward. And then in terms of the real estate management services, the leasing portfolio, we had challenges in the revenue generation. We had challenges in using state and unutilized properties. And this also goes back to working together with the Department of Social Development in availing some of the state properties for GBVF initiatives as well. So we also had some experiences challenges in that regard, despite some of the for facilities that have been provided to. I think there's still some issues where we find that upon investigation of some of these properties, you may find that you may have a valid property, but then when you're looking at it and you're examining it, you find that it may not be suitable for that. So quite a lot, few things need to be in place before you can actually give away or actually hand over that facility. I mean, I think there are also occupational health and safety matters, looking at the structural and longevity of that building, and also what may be required in terms of the facilities management aspect of it, the interaction between the building and the occupants of the building. So those are some of the basic things that also needs to be considered before you can actually. So you find that we have a large number of buildings that have been identified, but the suitability of it is also something that also needs to. And I think monies are also involved in terms of how do you bring them into a state that you can is reasonable for occupants as well. We had challenges with a percentage lease letter to companies with BEE and above. I think it's also the composition of the landlords within the space to try and transform that environment. And I think there's quite a lot of issues, external factors that must be considered in this regard, which also looking at collusion as well as interest as well, and also bypassing some of the regulations in terms of the bidding. That was some of the issues that need to be dealt with at a regulatory point of perspective, as well as also from a policy point of view in terms of advocacy of the empowerment aspect of within the leasing space. And then also from a small harbors as well as the coastal development is also to create opportunities in the case is to look at in harbor, small harbors and coastal areas, how then do we create a niche market or economies where you will find that those the people within those communities can actually create, and that is basically using some of the facilities where we say, if we are leasing out, there's also maintenance issues. At the harbors, there's docking of the ships, there's also maintenance of the ships, as ranching, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those things can also create a market for those small communities. And I think that is also dependent on the facilities themselves in terms of the state of the facility for it to be able to carry out an economic activity that will then have spin-offs of actually having these communities participating and creating their own ecosystem within that. And I think that's the challenge that we also have in terms of the state of our buildings. Then also, obviously, looking at the portfolio of leases, if it's not in a good state without all the necessary data, it's difficult also to look at what then will be the change in terms of our investment going forward and the charges in terms of the rent that we can also let out to those small harbors and coastal properties. So we also had a challenge in terms of that, where we had a small percentage of 10% based on the 20.1 million that was earmarked in the previous financial year, our base year, and so we wanted to generate about 10% of that. And because of the challenges of the state of our facilities and also not renewing the leases on time, etc., also affected the generation of revenue in that, sitting at 8.4%. Then with regards to construction, as I alluded, I think the major issue around construction is that construction has indicators that talk about the output of the of construction in terms of the quantum of projects that have been constructed, but within that space of the quantum are efficiency indicators when you look at within time, within budget. But I think in the spaces is also the relationship with the client departments in terms of provision of budget, availability of budget, as well as, you know, change of scope, et cetera, apart from some of these issues that I've highlighted earlier on about construction mafia. But I think there's generally issues around processes of extending times, approvals, budgets, and also delivering materials on time. I think this also looks at the uptake of the construction project since COVID or post-COVID, and also businesses as a whole. Not to say that we did not achieve because of COVID, but I think it's basically the entire value chain. I alluded earlier on when looking at construction recovery plan, we're looking at backward and forward linkages. So you find that the value chain itself, there was a slow uptake in terms of the value chain post-COVID, and that also resulted in extension of times and project value changes, et cetera, apart from just the construction mafia. But these are also some of the issues that affected construction in general. Then real estate and facilities. Now, real estate, which is the asset register, we'll talk in terms, I think the financials will also reflect that, and also the audit outcome on that. This was more on one of the things which is part of the sector, 5-year sector plan and integrating the provinces as well, is that we have a single repository of asset register as a whole, as a country. This is also the activity. So they're also looking at is assets that are physically verified to validate the existence of those and also assess their condition. And this is important in terms of existence and condition, because it then speaks to facilities management in terms of how then do we then plan and project or invest into assets that need maintenance, etc. So they are focusing on doing that, working together with the provinces. And I think one of the challenges is also that this is another area where it is the technical capacity that is required. And because of the structure as well as the demand for this to actually operate, it has also, the capacity has actually been of short term in terms of contract. And I think as contract end, it also affects the continuity of those. So we have experienced a number of officials who are on contract having to have left. And you find that also the softwares that were used in terms of moving away from and digitizing this process, also the challenges and the, right, because now if your contract ends and then you have a new person coming in, they still have to, you know, get themselves understanding the whole process, etc. So those are some of the teething aspects. I think administrative, those are issues that can be dealt with. And then land parcels vested for ownership is also working together with the law system, which is basically administered by the Department of Rural Development. Now, this is where the system also has title deed numbers, the SG diagrams, land use, etc. Now, for us to vest, we also need to have a diagram so that you can zone in and then put your GIS systems and ensuring that you're then looking at the right coordinates as well as the right properties. That then for vesting and confirming ownership, we are confirming what is actually within national sphere or is in the other spheres or other custodian. And that is also important in terms of then having that full scope of the asset register as well as ownership. And also assist in terms from a components and the as well as from the facilities management, then you are able to plan ahead on how then on what to invest, particularly with regards to maintaining those that have been identified for condition assessment. Now, in looking at all of this in terms of what then are we doing in terms of dealing with the poor or underperformance. Now, I'm linking the annual report because this is previous financially. I'm linking this with the annual performance plan. So this is the annual report of 21-22 financial year. Then you'll see that in the 22-23 annual performance plan, under the internal environment, we have put in these issues to say, we did not perform very well last year in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is how our indicators this financially, underpinned by the 10 principles which were presented to Parliament, will form the basis of these principles, values, as well as changing the culture in the organization to see how best we can then improve on performance. And these are the issues that we have brought in terms of the 10 principles. Change management, there are several workshops have been held. We've appointed champions. And I think the most important thing that we are sending as a message to the department is that every manager has a responsibility to be a change agent in their various units. It's not a project. It's not a project. It's a program that is embedded into the business of the organization to be change champions and driving a positive attitude towards service delivery. So those are issues that have been done. It's executive, the number of meetings, sessions that are there. Middle management is continuing, and then there are champions that are also driving. And this is the program I said is being championed by the deputy minister in ensuring that we move towards service delivery with a positive attitude. Service delivery improvement, again, also change attitude and perspective on how we view service delivery. We have a number of SLAs that we are working with, for instance, with COPTA and Public Protector as examples. And then we are also receiving positive feedback, particularly from an FM services, where services have been rendered. We've got that. We now have that feedback loop in terms of how was our service to the client department as part of contributing to the dignified client experience. So the service level agreements and that. And then we're working it together so that it then comes to the Batu Pili principles and ensuring that we maintain the QQT approach, quality, quantity, and time to ensure that there's service delivery at all levels. Business process management, which is now embedded into our process to ensure what we're also looking at is to ensure that there is no regional operations on the ground are not separate from the operations of the department because it's one department. So we've got a process where we have also done a regional model and a matrix that then also gives the level of responsibility and accountability to the regional managers in managing the regions as though they are the accounting officers of that region, which will then form part of the bigger value chain of the department-wide operational model. And that's one example that we can give. But this is also linked to service delivery improvement in terms of improving the business processes in the organization. The RP has spoken about it. We've appointed this CIO, who is also fast-tracking this issue as well. Macro business and delivery model is linked to business processes and service delivery, which is also part of why we're using the business, the macro business, in terms of delivering or developing our annual performance plan as well as operational plans. What we've done with the macro business and delivery model is that in the operational plans, the activities that drive those KPIs that you find in the APP, we need to see them in the business process standard operating procedures that then gives effect to the operations of the department. So those are the kind of things that we are also embedding in the process. Ethics, compliance, infrastructure and consequence management unit, I think this will be presented to members of the committee in terms of our approach, as well as the committee, ethics committee, and the 7 ethics risks that we've identified as part of our operational risk. Contract management and monitoring capacity is in progress, led by SCM on 2 fronts. One is contract administration, and then there's contract management. So there's that division and that integration to ensure that there's a necessary capacity that is supported and support that is given by SCM. And then there's also the management aspect and also monitoring by the line function within the SCM value chain or the procurement value chain to ensure that. Now, SCM has led a workshop with all the various units to ensure that we are all on the same page in understanding all of those issues. And then organizational-wide assessment, we've concluded and conducted a skills assessment, which I alluded earlier on, and then a maturity in terms of strategic risk. We've got a risk matrix as well as a maturity tool that then will look at the 12 strategic risks that have been identified in the department, where we're seeking to place the risk at the core of the operations of the department to ensure that we don't look at the risk as by the way, it's part of our day-to-day. And this links to the macro business model, where you'll find that there is now a connection between the activities that drive the performance of the organization with the risk associated with that, so that in mitigating the risk, you are automatically improving the performance of the organization that then will lead to the improvement in service delivery. Clean audit, I think we'll also discuss that, as this is an initiative and as well as part of it, through the CFO's office, manages this every year and is managed and monitored weekly for all those that have been affected by the outcomes. And I think we'll also explain during the presentation the adverse opinion or the opinion that has been expressed on the department. Chair and members of the committee, I think that's from a non-financial point of view, this is a high-level summary. We recognize designated groups and promotion of women and persons with disabilities. We've just concluded a session with the gender unit, where we are also looking at the spread of all the various units that also contribute to that. We are also focusing on what is the future work of the organization. We are focusing on the rail rules and regulation. We're also focusing on labor regulations as well, where we now zoom in into how then do we then contribute to promoting women and persons with disabilities. So this is now part and parcel. I think in the next presentations to Parliament, if we're called on the APP, we'll also demonstrate how we have done this, and also how we use the efficiency and the digital platform to then drive some of the operations of the organization through in areas where there are human errors. There are controls that then are actually put in place in terms of the systems, and in the areas where the system fails, there is sufficient capacity from a human point of view to actually drive those systems towards service delivery. Thank you, Chair. I think the next session will be on the financial performance. Thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you, Lwazi. I think on the financials, it's going to be CEO. We welcome DM and acting DG. So Honourable Frans Kalvig's hand is up. Honourable Frans Kalvig, or is it a legacy hand?
It's in advance, Chair. Thank you.
It's in advance.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Now let's also get the financials, and then we ask questions after that. Thank you. Over to Mandla. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Aaron Mazibuka. I'll be presenting DPWI financials. Chair, if we move to slide number 15. Slide number 15, it shows how the department has been performing. As you can see, since 2014-15 to 2021-22 financial year, the department has been sitting under unqualified. Then we move to the next slide. The next slide will be showing the unqualified and the matters of emphasis. And for the 2021-22 financial year, it is two matters. The first one relates to impairment. The second one relates to fruitless and wasteful and expenditure assessment. We'll move to the next slide, which is the actual financials. For the 2021 financial year, the department had a budget of 8.4 billion. And as at the end of March, 8 billion was spent, which is equivalent to 97%. If you look at the economic classification, you will see the significant underspending is under three areas. The first one is compensation of employees. The second one is goods and services. The last one is under transfers, which is the non-profit institutions. Now, if one can explain the reasons for the underspending, and starting with compensation of employees for 81 million, this is relating to three factors. The first one, it is the delay in filling of the positions that were prioritized and they were vacant. And the second one relates to the salary adjustment that was projected, but there was no salary increase except the non-pensionable of around 1.5 that was implemented. Then the last one, it is the positions that were vacated. Some of them were employees were promoted within the department. For goods and services, we have the underspending of 113 million. As you can see in the next slide, in terms of the analysis, we'll go to the next slide later. The reasons for underspending under goods and services is because the department was still operating within the lockdown, where most of the activities were not fully being implemented, and things like the office occupation, where there was a low spending in terms of the expenditure for water and electricity, traveling was less and resulted in low spending in terms of traveling and subsidiary. And also the consumer goods such as stationery and printing, the spending was low. Under transfers and subsidies, we have 64 million that was underspent. The underspending relates to EPWP non-state sector. The budget for the non-state sector was 1 billion, only 956 million was transferred after the EPWP assessed that the IDT will not be spending the 64 million, and that resulted in the underspending as the money was not transferred to the IDT. We also have the underspending of 11 million under machinery and equipment, and that underspending, it is linked to compensation of employees because the bulk of the expenditure under machinery and equipment relate to the recruitment or the replacement of the computers. Then we'll move to the next slide. The next one, the analysis relates to what I was explaining. The slide number 19, Chair, I will be presenting the statement of financial performance. So your statement of financial performance, previously it was called the income statement. In this statement, Chair, we are comparing the revenue and the expenditure. The revenue, it is made up mainly of the budget that we are receiving, which is the annual appropriation. When you compare the two financial years, there is an increase between the two financial year, and the difference between the two financial year, it is 629. We also have the revenue that has increased between the two financial years. In 2020-21 financial year, we received 9 million. For 2022 financial year, the revenue that was generated from the department is 15 million. The main source of the revenue for the department relates to the interest. When the money is being transferred to IDC, the interest that is being generated, it will be surrendered back to the department. So if there is an increase in terms of the allocation, then it means it will result in more interest being generated. Under the expenditure, these are the same as what I've presented, but the difference here, we are only focusing on the expenditure. Between the two financial years, there is an increase of 12 million under compensation of employees. I have indicated the reasons for the underspending. Within services, also there is an improvement. In 2020-21 financial year, we spent 236 million, and for 2021-22 financial year, the expenditure increased to 280 million. Transfers and subsidies, there was an increase because of the additional funding that was allocated, where the budget increased from 6.8 billion to 7.3 billion in 2021-23 financial year. So I will not be talking to the tangible capital assets. There was an increase of 3 million in terms of the assets that we acquired in comparison to 2021 financial year. We'll move to the next slide, which is the slide number 21. Under slide number 21, it is a statement of financial position or the balance sheet statement. In this segment, Chair, will be focusing on the assets and the liabilities. Under the liabilities, we are also making comparison between 2021-22 financial year to see if there is a movement in terms of whether the assets have increased or decreased, and will provide the reasons for the increase, specifically where we have a significant increase. Chair, under the current assets, the unauthorized expenditure, there is no increase and there is no decrease. It means all the unauthorized expenditure remain the same because the reported expenditure has not been resolved. The report has been submitted to Treasury. There is an engagement between Treasury and the department to clarify the issues before the report can be submitted to Parliament for the condonement. Under cash and cash equivalents, Chair, for 2021 financial year, the department reported 125,000. For 21-22 financial year, it has increased to 216 million. The increase relates to the money that was supposed to have been surrendered and paid over to Treasury, but the money was surrendered late in the financial year and therefore could not be paid over to Treasury. So that is the reason why we have the 216 million. And that money mainly relates to the underspending of the non-state sector for the budget that was allocated for 2021 financial year. If I move to the liabilities, Chair, under the voltage funds, as you can compare, you can see that there is an increase in terms of the funds that should be surrendered. For 2021, we have surrendered 193. For 2021-22 financial year, it has increased by 272. The bulk of the money here relates to the underspending. We also have the revenue that I have indicated, that the significant increase relates to the interest. And we also have the overdraft that has improved in comparison to the 2021 financial year, because in 2021 financial year we reported 83, But for 21-22 financial year, we reported 42 million. The main reason for the overdraft in the department relates to the unauthorized expenditure. If the unauthorized expenditure has been resolved, then the overdraft will also disappear. Under the payables chair, for 2021, we reported 59 million or 60 million. But for 21-22 financial year, it has increased the payables to 233 million. The reason for the increase, it is the money that was received as the underspending for 2021, but could not be paid over to National Treasury. Hence, we have a huge increase under the payables. We'll move to the next slide, which is the slide number 23. The slide number 23, Chair, the next slide, please. The slide number 23, Chair, here it is the analysis of the overdraft. What is the items that are contributing to overdraft? If you look at the top, we have 261 million. As I've indicated, that the main driver for the bank overdraft, it is the unauthorized expenditure. We also have the assets and the liabilities. And if you look at the comparison, you can see that they are not much, but the main reason for the unauthorized, the overdraft, it is the unauthorized. If that can be resolved, then the overdraft will disappear. We'll move to the next slide. The next slide, Chair, these are the disclosure notes that we thought it will be important if we can show them. There are others, but these are the ones that we thought if we can present them, because they are important. The first one, it is the contingent liability. Under contingent liability, our contingent liability has increased from 17 million in 2021 to 18 million. The main reason for the contingent liabilities, it is relating to the labor relation matters. The other one, it will be the accrual, where the accrual have increased from 15 million to 21 million. And as you can see under the reason, the increase mainly relates to the other government entities where the service was procured and the invoice were received but could not be paid before the end of the financial year. The other one that has decreased, it is the employee benefit. The employee benefit mainly relate to the leave that not being utilized by the end of the financial year. Between the two financial years, you can see that there is an improvement because in 2021, we reported 61 million, and for 21-22 financial year, it is 54 million. We'll move to the next slide, which is the unauthorized expenditure. As I've indicated, Chair, we still have the same unauthorized expenditure, and therefore we did not incur the new expenditure, or some of the reported unauthorized expenditure have not been resolved. So the amount remains the same for both 2021 financial year and 2021-22 financial year. We'll move to the next slide, which is the irregular expenditure. Chairperson, under the irregular expenditure, it is only one area where we have the increase in terms of the irregular expenditure, and that relates to the irregular appointment. The matter is still under investigation in the department. As long as the matter has not been resolved on annual basis, the department will continue to report the irregular expenditures. In terms of the new cases, except the one for the irregular appointment, we did not have new cases of the irregular expenditure. We'll move to the next slide, which will be the last one. Chair, the last one, it is the fruitless and wasteful expenditure where we reported 973,000 in 2021 the amount remained the same. The same as the unauthorized expenditure, we don't have new cases of the fruitless and wasteful expenditure being reported at the end of 21-22 financial year. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Good afternoon, Chairperson. My name is Mandla Sithole, and good afternoon to members of the Portfolio Committee, EM, and acting DG and colleagues. I'll present the financial reports of PMTE, starting with the slide that is appearing, which is the executive summary of the audit report, where the PMTE received a disclaimer audit opinion. It's mainly because of property, plant, and equipment, which is mainly known as immovable asset register. I must indicate, Chair and members, that it's unfortunate that we received a disclaimer because of limitation of scope, where the recon that AG expected for his statement was submitted late, and we even tried to request for extension of the audit, which unfortunately was not approved by Auditor General. However, there were other qualification matters, which is payable from exchange transactions, where there was an understatement of 245 million and payables from exchange transaction, which is accrued expenses, and payables from exchange transaction, which is accrued expenses. There were also emphasis of matters that were addressed by Auditor General, which is impair on receivables, the going concern, and irregular expenditure. Then if you go to the next slide, which is slide 30, it's just a trend how the PMTE has been performing in terms of the audit outcomes. One can see that if you compare to the previous financial year, we did regress as per the reasons that are already outlined. If you go to the next slide, please. I've already explained this one. You can move to slide 32. Next slide, please. Thank you. So this is just a summary of, can you go back? Slide 32. Thank you. This is a summary of the financial position, which is assets. I will start with the assets. The current assets for PMTE at year end, we're sitting at 4.8 billion, which is less than what was disclosed in the previous financial year, where it was 5.6 billion. The details are below, where you have receivables from exchange transactions, which also decreased from 5.2 billion to 4.4 billion. It's mainly because the recovery rate in certain areas was improved. However, there was significant impairment that we had to impair, which is an accounting transaction in terms of GRAP, which AG has already raised as a part of the emphasis of matters, where we are not collecting all the data that are due to the department. Then on operating lease assets is 379 million, which is less than what we had reported last year. So it's a reduction of 48 million. Then cash and cash equivalent, it's also a reduction where it decreased from 4.6 to 2 million. The main decrease there is as a result of the commercial bank account, which was then accounted for before year end. So basically, it's as a result of the decrease in deposit receipt. Then the total net current assets, there was no material changes there. It's even below 1%. Our net current assets remain at 140 billion. Then your total assets, it's 145 billion. There is a slight decrease there if you compare to the previous financial year of 146 billion. Then next slide on financial position, which is the liabilities category. The current liabilities, there was a slight increase if you compare to the previous financial year, where we reported 11.7 billion compared to 10.7 billion of the previous financial year. then the details are below, where you have operating lease liability that is sitting at 370 million compared to 426 million of the previous financial year. It's mainly because of the leases that were expired at year end, and there were new leases that were concluded at year end. Then your bank overdraft has increased slightly if you compare to 905 million, which is now 1 billion. There is a, that increase. Then deferred revenue, it has increased from 3.4 billion to 4 billion. It's mainly because of a delayed project which were not completed on time. As a result, the revenue has been deferred, which increases the liability. Payables from exchange transactions, it's there is a slight increase of less than 1%, which is 4.7 billion. If you compare to the previous year, it was also around 4.7 billion. Then the other significant line item, it's employee obligations, which is 206 million, whereas in the previous financial year was 242 million. The decrease there is as a result of decrease in leave and performance bonuses from the obligation point of view of PMTE. Then provisions also increase from 766 million to 923 million. And it's mainly because of increase in day-to-day maintenance provision. So the non-current liabilities has increased also, slightly increased by 2% from 2.9 billion to 3 billion. Then the total liabilities also increased by about a billion from 13.7 billion to 14.7 billion. The net assets, it's 130 billion, which is has decreased by 1.9 billion if you compare to the previous financial year. The next slide, it's a statement of financial performance highlights, where we reported the deficit of 1.9 billion for 2021 financial year. If you were to compare to the previous year of 945 million, which is a decrease. The main reason for the increase of deficit supply of deficit, it's as a result of the deferred revenue, which I've already explained, which increased from 960 million to 1.2 billion, and the impairment of receivables, which also increased from 1.4 billion to 2.8 billion. Then the statement of financial performance, which is the next slide. Thank you. Then the total revenue was 17.1 billion, which is more or less the same as the previous financial year with a slight decrease, and the details are below. Then the reasons for the decrease is the revenue that was recognized due to deferred revenue, where there was a decrease, as I explained in the previous slide. Then the total expenses, it's 9 billion, which has increased if one were to compare with the previous financial year of 16.4 billion. I must highlight, Chair and members, the reason for such an increase in revenue, it's mainly for the accounting transactions, which is your depreciation of 3.1 billion, as you can see in the second slide, second line item of total expenses. And also, if you look at the impairment on receivables, it increased from 1.4 billion to 2.8 billion. So if you look at those two line items, which are not cash items, they are just accounting transactions, they've increased our revenue by 5.9 billion. Hence, you see total expenses to be more at 19 billion. Then the other significant items is operating leases, which is your private leases at 5.2 billion. It's also a slight increase compared to the previous financial year of 5.1 billion. Property maintenance is 2.7 billion, where it's also an increase from 2.1 billion to 2.7 billion. Property rates also increased from 1.2 billion to 1.7 billion. Then sundry operating expenses decreased from 1.5 billion to 1.3 billion. As the members are aware that in the previous financial year, we were paying for quarantine sites. That did not happen much in the last financial year, hence there was such a decrease in operating expenses. The next slide is just the analysis of accumulated surpluses over the years. Can you move to the next slide, please? Thank you. This shows how we've been performing in terms of accumulated surplus or deficit. If you look at the year under review, we reported 1.9 billion. I've already explained the reason for that. It was mainly because of the impairment on receivables and deferred revenue that also decreased. So as a result, there was a deficit of 1.9 billion. Then the next slide is summary of actual receipts. This is a summary of actual receipts, the cash that we actually received. One will also compare with the projected receipts that we projected at the beginning of the year. On lease, on accommodation charges, which is a leasehold, it's private leases where we are leasing properties from the landlords. We projected to receive 5.3 billion. The actual receipt was 5 billion, which is sitting at 94% in terms of recovery rate. Accommodation charges, which is state owned, we projected 8 billion. We actually received 6.6 billion, which is 82% recovery rate. Accommodation charge freehold, which is your rental debtors, it's increased from 56. Actually, we received 56 million, whereas our projection was 68 million, which is 83% recovery rate. Augmentation, which is a transfer from the main vault, that was 100%. Then the other significant line item, it's municipal service management fee, which we recovered 164 million. Compared to the projected revenue of 252 million, which represents 65%. Then municipal services recovered. We projected to receive 4.4 billion and the actual receipt was 3.2 billion, which is 74% recovery rate. So the total revenue that was actually received is 19.6 billion, which represents 87% recovery rate. And the next slide. Thank you. The next slide is basically showing us where is the biggest source of our revenue as PMTE. Our revenue is mainly from accommodation charges, which is state owned, with a 35.6%. I must explain on this one, Chair, because we always compare private leases with this one. Actually, departments are occupying about 97% of our immovable asset register, which actually it's about 27,000 properties which are occupied by government departments. So if we were to charge market related, actually we'll charge far more than what we are currently charged. So basically, plans department are occupying state properties almost at a nominal rate, if I can put it that way, for the lack of a better way. Whereas on leases, we have less than 2,500 leases. So if one were to compare, you have clients that are occupying 77,000 properties against leases that are less than 2,500, which means most of the portfolio of our asset is occupied by clients' departments. But it's a discussion also that we are having with Treasury so that we can improve in this area in terms of collection of revenue for PMTE. Then the next slide its summary of expenditure outcome per COVID classification. I will highlight a few things there. I won't go into details for the interest of time. The total expenditure for current payments, the budget was 18 billion. We actually spent 16.7 billion, which represent 92% of spending. Then the concern there, which the members may be more worried, it's on leasing. The spending was 84%, so there was a variance of 886 million in terms of the spending. I must indicate in this case that there are a lot of renegotiation that happened with landlords. As a result, then there was that saving. But in some instances is where we may not have paid the landlord for whatever reason. Then the other area that the committee may be concerned is on infrastructure spending, where our spending, particularly on capital recoverable, where we spend 73% against the budget of 2.2 billion. So the actual spending was 1.6 billion. If you compare to the previous year where we spent 90% for the same line item, then capital non-recoverable, we had a budget of 2.2 billion and the spending was 1.3 billion, which represents 61% spending, which is an improvement compared to the previous financial year where we spent 54%. Machinery and equipment, is 54%, whereas in the previous financial year was 22%. So the total spending on infrastructure was 3 billion against the budget of 4.5 billion, which represents 67%. So from the total percentage point of view, there was no improvement. The same percentage that was reported in the last financial year is the same as this one in the current, in the year under review. The next slide. Next slide, please. Thank you. This also shows how we are spending. The significant line item for spending, it's leases, which is private leases, where we pay the landlords, which is 24.4% of our expenditure, and followed by municipal services, 19.8%, then maintenance is 12%, and other areas I won't mention. Then the summary of expenditure outcome per program is the next slide, which is slide number 41. Thank you. So administration, the spending was 97%. I'm not going to into details. I'll just focus on the percentages. Then real estate investment services, the spending was 86%. And then CPM, 72%, where there was a slight increase compared to the previous financial year where the spending was 70%. Real estate management services, 91%, which has not changed compared to the previous financial year where we reported 91%. Real estate information and register services, 96% spending, and FM, 97%. So the overall spending was sitting at 87%. Let's move to the next slide, slide 42. Thank you. On slide 42, there was a slight decrease of irregular expenditure if you were to compare with the previous financial year where we had 1.9 billion, whereas in 2021-22 financial year, it's 1.8 billion. One can see the trend where we are coming from with irregular expenditure, where we have witnessed the reduction on irregular expenditure. Where we are coming from, where we used to have 32 billion irregular expenditure. And we have also made an application to National Treasury for condonement of 1.6 billion, and Treasury is processing that request. we hope we'll get an outcome before end of November. If that 1.6 billion were to be condoned, the PMT will have less than 500 million irregular expenditure, which will be a good progress. Then on fruitless and wasteful expenditure, there was no much increase. It's sitting at 88 million compared to the previous financial year where it was 88 million. Investigations are underway to address non-compliance on fruitless expenditure. Can move to the next slide. Next slide, please. Next slide. Next slide. Thank you. Then here is just the total outstanding debt as at 31st March 2022. I must indicate on this one, we are just showing the gross figures, whereas in the financial statements, we reflected the amounts after impairment, as I have explained previously, that we impaired a significant amount of debtors, hence AG also raised the as an emphasis of matters. The outstanding balance for prior year was 5.1 billion, mainly because of municipal services at 3.8 billion. Sorry, I'm on slide number 45. Can you go back to slide 45, please? Thank you. Thank you. Then amounts invoiced for the year 21-22 was 17.2 billion, and the amount received was 14 billion, which represent 82% recovery rate if you compare what was invoiced in that particular financial year compared to what was received. However, the concern is still the old balances where clients are disputing and where clients are not paying, and they have different reasons for that. Some, they say they don't have money to pay us because their budget was reduced by National Treasury. Then the total balance at year end was sitting at 8.2 billion. Next slide, please. This just shows the age analysis of 8.2 billion that I've already explained. Under current as at year end, it was 850 million. Those were current invoices as at 31st March 2022. And the invoices were due over 30 days was 259 million. And more than 60 days was 1.9 billion. And the total was 3.1 billion at year end. The previous year was sitting at 5.1 billion, which makes 8.2 billion. So one can see that clients, on average, they don't pay within 30 days as per this age analysis. However, a significant concern is on previous year's balances, which are old balances. The next slide, please, which is my last slide. Next slide. Thank you. These are the interventions that have been put in place. We have requested National Treasury to consider ring-fencing accommodation budget, because when there is a budget cut, clients see it fit to jump to this area where they cut budget that they ought to pay to public works. As I said earlier on, clients occupy more than 77,000 properties. And when there are conditions of poor maintenance and so on, and yet clients, they are not paying us at least a recovery cost. That's why then we find a situation where our properties are not well maintained. It's because of things like this where clients are not paying on time. And linked to that also, we are not getting the correct tariff structure where then clients must pay for properties that we are availing to them. Then what we also requested Treasury to consider is to appropriate the budget for infrastructure, because as the landlord of the state, it makes sense that infrastructure must be paid by the landlord, and then clients must pay the user charge, which will then be determined appropriately. But in this case, clients are sitting with the infrastructure budget, and they give us problems when they have to pay. It's either they will tell us that we must stop this project while we have contractor on site. As a result, it caused unnecessary delays. Then also, we also requested Treasury to issue instruction note for all clients to pay us in advance. And all these interventions, they are being considered by National Treasury. I must indicate that it's not the first time we are making this request to National Treasury. We did the same in previous years and last year in particular, but Treasury is processing our request. Then implementation of user charge model through the itemized billing. This is where then clients ought to pay at least recovery costs for the facilities that we are availing to them so that PMTE can be self-sustainable in terms of finances and be able to maintain properties to be in a condition that would be suitable for the clients. So the same clients are willing to pay for private leases, but when it comes to state-owned properties, they want to pay a nominal rental, and they are the first one to complain about the conditions of our properties. Then the minister also has made interventions where letters were written to ministers, and we've seen also improvements. As I indicated, there was an improvement on recovery rate for the invoices that were issued in the year that ended 31st March 2022, and some disputes were also resolved as a result of such intervention. And there are continuous meetings with DG to DG, and also even at foresight level, where the accounting officer met all accounting officers, and we've seen improvement in such in certain instances where some disputes were addressed as a result of such intervention. Some clients started to pay on monthly basis. However, some clients complain about service delivery, as I indicated earlier on. If we don't get enough money, clients will continue to complain about the condition of our facilities, and yet they are not willing to pay at least the cost recovery rate. Some clients do not have budgets due to budget cuts. I've already indicated that. We've also devolved municipal services. We are charging also interest. We are making follow-ups. There are instances also where we refer certain things to National Treasury for intervention. One in particular is the DCS one, where we have referred to National Treasury to intervene. Then the impact of the intervention has not always yielded the desired outcome. User department have no budget to pay outstanding claims. The reduction of budget by National Treasury has affected accommodation recovery, as I have outlined earlier on. Some of the disputes are not yet resolved by the department, or the client is not also willing to engage us to resolve those disputes. The budget of user department has been used for other purposes, where as we interact with clients, they will tell us that we'll see you public works towards the end of the financial year. So where they have savings, that's when we'll start to receive money from the clients. DPW invoices are not given the priority by user departments, and the collection rate at year end was 82%, which is below what we targeted, which was 95%. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mandla. In fact, let me appreciate all the presentations that have been done by the department and PMTE. There is a lot that honourable members can engage on, starting from the first presentation up to the last. So we will have to allow honourable members to raise their questions. Say 5 minutes each member, so that we can then have follow-ups. Not to say you are asking questions now, then there are other questions that you will ask hoping that all the members, they have noted their questions. According to, remember, we had Honorable Professor Calvey raising her hand in advance. So she will be our number one, followed by Honorable Graham Murray, followed by Honorable Hicklin, followed by Honorable Matebula. In that order, Honorable Franz Kalweg, Honorable Graham Murray, Honorable Hicklin, Honorable Matebula. Those are the hands that I can see for now.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Please, I want to speak first before I totally lose my voice. I have 110 questions, Chair, but now you are limiting me with the 5 minutes, so I'll abide by the orders of the Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to welcome the report that has been presented and acknowledge the continuous good performance through a qualified audit opinion of the department. However, we are so sad to see the regression of the PMTE in terms of the current disclaimer that they've received. So, Chairperson, I would go straight into the issues. In terms of I think before I move into the issues, I think it's important, Chairperson, to welcome the input and the way that the previous acting DG, Mr. Faisal, was steering the ship. We really appreciate what he has done, and we're wishing him well in his future endeavors. It will really be a loss to this department. Then, Chairperson, moving forward, I'm very worried, Chairperson, when looking at the since the start, sorry, Chairperson, I didn't acknowledge the DM. She was not previously when I spoke in our meeting, so I would really recognize her presence also. So we know that the ministry has been constant on the issue of the 30-day payments, and they've excelled to 21 days. But then we see PMTE having a more than 100 days payment. So we would really need for individuals to benchmark from each other in order to perform on this area of speciality. Then, Chairperson, the irregular expenditure, a balance, is a point of concern, and especially the zero recovery process in terms of the irregular expenditures. Then, Chairperson, when I look at the infrastructure, the number of infrastructure projects, I see that there's 95 out of 128 being completed, but then we see the delayed projects of 187. So to me, it's really an unrealistic target that has been set to be manipulated in such a manner that it shows that they excel instead of they are underperforming. I am worried about the irregular expenditures of PMTE, the high rate of that amount. Then, Chairperson, I'll really need to get a second bite. When we look at the under expenditure program in terms of program one of the DPWI, we see that under expenditure in terms of filling of vacant posts, which is combined to a total of 36 million rand. And it's a point of concern under this strenuous economic circumstances and high unemployment. So we really need to do things differently, and real efforts needs to be made, including the issue, Chairperson, of the number of vacancies, not vacancies, the number of people leaving the department as well as PMTE. I'm noticing the department have 70 nine persons leaving, but I'm specifically very worried about the PMPE, who saw a number of 1,855 people leaving the entity, which are 189 in terms of resignation and 1,537 in terms of contracts being expiring. So my question in this instance would be, what are you doing to retain people, to do exit interviews, and also to absorb people whose contracts comes to an end, to ensure that you maintain a vacancy, a low vacancy rate? Then, Chief, a person, in terms of employment of foreign nationals, we see that there's some kind of 30 foreign nationals being employed, which relates to one admin officer and 27 professionals and managers. Would that be an indication that they can't find locals who can occupy those positions, or what are they doing to employ locals in those positions? I'm over my time, so I'll pause there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Van Schalvik. Honorable Grandmare.
Thanks, Chair. Can we just ask Honorable Matabula to mute, because it keeps making a noise on the platform. Okay, so I'm going to speak, thanks Honorable Matabula. I'm going to speak less to the actual presentation than to the actual report, the financial statements. On page 24 of the financial statements, it speaks to the fact that construction management services from the department underspent, and they listed the underspending both for that program and for facilities management as being as a result of contractors delaying in execution and finalization and extensions of time and late submissions of accounts. Both for facilities management and for construction management. My question is what action has been taken against the defaulting contractors? Are we taking action? Do we still use them? Do we blacklist? Do we penalize? Also that there's delays from the client sides. What mitigations are we taking there? And then the underspend on employees is remediable. And why are we not remedying that? Every single year, as we said with the Auditor General's report as well, every single year we are underspending on employees. And this doesn't have to be the case. Also, it said on facilities management, part of the underspend was because of the delay in the tender for the cleaning and gardening. Why did this happen? In terms of the vacancy rates, the department continues to say that there's an 11% vacancy rate, whereas our research has established that there's a 13% vacancy rate. Why is there a difference in those numbers? On page 62, you speak about productive assets, and one of those is obviously the small harbours. And in there it says, that they received proposals for leases from people, and those were kind of ignored. So I want to know why that letting out strategy was delayed for so long, why they didn't look at the proposals coming in from people, and why they have failed to secure the leases, additional leases at the small harbours. This is actually a basis of a measurable for the department, and yet they have completely failed to deal with the leases in small harbours for the entire financial year. On page 63, it says their revenue increased through letting out of state-owned, and there's the 99 coastal properties. The reported achievement here is actually disingenuous. The increase was due to annual increases, not to new lease agreements, because you actually say there that no new lease agreements were signed. So claiming that you've actually achieved the target or achieved an increase is somewhat disingenuous in terms of the documentation. Page 70, there was an underspend there that you blame on COVID. COVID was blamed for previous years on the underspend, whereas we've got no real excuses this time around. Also, there's been an underspend on IGR by 72.7%. And this is where you can address problems with client departments. So IGR is one of the sections that should not have an underspend if we are going to try and address issues with client departments for non-payments and non-adherence. On page 83, we speak about the properties, and they reference poor properties or properties in poor condition, properties in very poor condition. The Auditor General kept referring to 66,000 properties. The DPWI in their document has 77,517. I want to know why there's such a big difference in terms of the numbers that are being referred to. And according to what you say in those AFS, there is no actual strategy to deal with these properties. It says there that there's no budget. So you're going to just kind of do a needs assessment and put it on the list, and that's going to be it. That's not addressing the issue. And that means that those properties are going to continue to disintegrate, and it's going to be massive. On page 120, you referred to performance agreements. There are two salary level 16 employees that do not have performance level performance agreements. I'd like to know who those two are and why they don't have those. On page 155, you've got zero salary level 16 for performance agreements, but earlier that's on the PMPE side, but in an earlier thing, you've actually got somebody in that position, one out of two. So I just want to know why there's that discrepancy. Page 158, again, I agree with my colleague who spoke before me, they're the 30 foreign workers. My question is that there are 22 Cubans that form part of that 30. Who are the other eight? Where are they from? And why are they necessary? And in particular, I can understand technical advisors because maybe we don't have the technical skills. And I know that has been the reason provided by the minister was that there are certain water mitigation measures that we haven't experienced and that the Cubans bring that technical expertise. But why would we need foreign nationals in an elementary function and as admin officers? I don't understand that. Chair, I'm going to stop there because my next set of questions are on the PMT, so I'd like to have a second bite. My last one before I go, sorry, is that 122 million rand was allocated for infrastructure development coordination. Now I'm assuming that's Infrastructure South Africa. When you look at the organogram, Infrastructure South Africa is a separate branch. You've got PMTE, you've got the department and Infrastructure South Africa. All the other branches and departments and entities are providing us with annual financials or giving us feedback on the expenditure, etc. And yet we get nothing from ESA. 122 million rand allocated and nothing from them. So I'd like to know why there is no feedback whatsoever in terms of the expenditure around ESA. I'll stop there for now.
Thank you, Honorable Hickley.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'm going to kick off. My comments are with DPWI and PMTE on the same lot, Chair. And they all hinge around underspending of budgets and or not meeting recommendations and specifications on the PFMA. On slide 18, it says that 64.3 million rand of the EPWP non-state sector was for PPE was given to a contractor who did not deliver goods. My question is, who was the contractor? Was he struck off the roll? 1.5 million rand for integrated grants was not paid due to, sorry, I can't read my own handwriting, due to non-compliance with the DORA. Division of Revenue Act. Who was this contractor? Can we please know who the name was, and why was the is that contractor still on the books of the DPWI? We speak on. You've spoken about the 261 million rand of unauthorized expenditure. On slides 25, 26, and 27. We speak about 86% of underspending on budget in terms of employees, compensation of employees. And we have such a ridiculously high unemployment rate in this country. How can we not have positions filled in the DPWI? I don't understand it. We have graduates across the country screaming out for jobs, and yet we have vacancies. Billions of people screaming for jobs, vacancies in the DPWI, and we don't fill the positions. It astounds me every single solitary time. We raise this with every single SOE that we deal with in the DPWI. There are constantly calls for vacancies to be filled. We have highly qualified people in South Africa who could fill those positions. We don't fill the positions. We constantly underspend in those positions. We constantly talk about the fact that there are problems within the DPWI. We speak about issues that have to be highlighted, that are highlighted either to the minister or to the deputy minister. We make recommendations. Well, we don't make recommendations. Recommendations are made and they are never followed through. They are recommendations that get made year in and year out. And they get made by the committee, by the Auditor General, and it gets repeated and repeated and never acted upon. There are always issues of fruitless and wasteful expenditure that get repeated and not acted upon. Recommendations are made and we are not told what the resolutions are if the recommendations are carried forward through to Cabinet or National Treasury. Going on to the PMTE, I have to ask this question. Is the PMTE in need of business rescue due to a decrease in revenue recognized from deferred revenue, recoverables that are not recovered, maintenance and maintenance projects that just never get off the ground, non-payment of client departments, disputes raised by clients, such as the telecom towers. I mean, that's a perfect example. Loss of income, loss of disposable assets, and a deficit of 149%. I mean, the Auditor General reported on this extensively. Where is the consequence management? Especially when you look at fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Section 38(1)(h) of the PFMA requires that action must be taken by the minister against people who perpetuate and who are responsible for fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And yet we are told about people who have the ability to override Archibus and Sage, and nothing's done about it. I mean, we have countless examples of the PFMA Section 39, subsection 2I, that also states that an accounting officer has to report on under collection of revenue. And yet again, that doesn't happen. There are two specific sections within the PFMA that dictate that a minister has to act against people within a department who do not comply with the law, and yet nothing happens. We have to have measurable consequence management within the DPWI against the DPWI and the PMTE. We have statutes that can act against this, and yet as a portfolio committee, where our job is to have oversight over the legislature, nothing gets done. I'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Hicklin. Honourable Matebula. Honourable Matebula.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. My greetings to you, the whip of the committee, as well as the Deputy Minister, the administration, and my fellow colleagues, members of Parliament. Chair, well, let me start first with the PMTE. and raise the same concern and the disappointment that has been raised by my colleagues here in relation to the issue of the disclaimer. This is a very bad, I think it's the worst thing that a department may get, because this must tell you that something went very wrong. Because here you speak of possible corruption, irregular expenditures, wasteful, fruitless, and as well as unauthorized, expenditures. And when you speak of this, you are talking about monies that are taken out from the public purse. And I would wish to see this improvement taking place in the next financial year, Chair, that they are not in the same position as they are. And I hope that, as it was indicated, that like, for instance, the issue of fruitful and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, that there are investigations that are actually taking place, then that those investigations are going to reveal as to what went wrong and who was responsible for that. And I'm sure that we are going to be benefited with the outcomes of that particular investigation. Like I have said, Chair, that is a very bad news. It's the news that cannot be accepted by this committee. But Chair, I must also commend them because they have taken a step to say we are doing something to correct this. And I want to assure them that we are behind them, we are giving them all the support that they need. Chair, I want to move to IDT. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I mean IDT speaks of having underspent, and the reasons of understanding are that of saying is because of staff. For me, I can accept they cannot or they couldn't has got a high number of people who are unemployed, and a huge number of people who are unemployed comes from young people, who some of them are graduates. Now, who are loitering around the streets and their homes, who have become burdens to their families. And then you've got such an entity that cannot, fill posts. And without giving any reason as to why are they not filling those posts. And secondly, Chair, on the very same entity, is with regard to the issue of overdraft. It is indicated that the overdraft is as a result of, irregular, unauthorized expenditure. Now, if you speak unauthorized, Chair, they can't come here and say if this cannot take place any longer, it will not be there any longer. We want them to do an investigation with regard to the unauthorized, expenditure, which gave birth to the increase of the overdraft. The same as the PMTE indicated that they are conducting an investigation. I'd want or wish to see, they doing the same thing. Well, another thing on the very same entity is the issue of irregular wasteful expenditure or fruitless and wasteful expenditure. They indicate that the same amount of money that was indicated in the last, in the previous financial year, 2021, 2022, or 2020, 2021 is the same as 2021, 2022. Now, I ask myself a question that if this is the case, how do you have rents and cents being the same in the two financial years? I think there's something which is not correct, for which I would be glad if one can be provided with clarity. One last matter, Chair. Honorable Van Schalkwyk indicated that the PMTE pays its service providers over 100 days. You know, I must indicate here, Chair, that, you know, the issue of paying within 30 days is not a matter of a principle. It's a policy matter. So it's not a matter by choice. It's a matter that you are required by policy that you pay service providers within 30 days. But I think there was a reason why that there was such a policy. Because, you know, Chair, many businesses, many businesses are collapsing today because of us as the state paying them very late. And some of them, they end up having their properties being attached. And I'm sure from where we are, we cannot be happy about it. When we've got a policy or policies that are in place that are not being complied with. So, Chair, I would want to say that the PMTE must work around the clock if they know what I'm talking about, especially of collapsing of businesses of service providers. And in particular, those people who are, whose businesses are collapsing, as we care so much about all people of South Africa, that they should have businesses that thrive, you see. And then you've got this type of a PMTE that is collapsing there. I want to indicate that if you look at the numbers, they can go and check their numbers. They will find it as the way I'm saying it, that the majority of the businesses that are collapsing because of people are being paid late are businesses that are being owned by Africans, and of which that is a worry. Lastly, Chair, as indicated, well, we listened to the presentation that was done by the AG. As I have indicated on the issue of the disclaimer, I'll use this figuratively, Chair. I'm not insulting anyone. I think the AG must start, biting. It must stop being a fruitless bulldog. It must start biting. If in an event that there's someone who misuses the funds, there's corruption, there's this, they must be able to come in and make sure that those people, they pay for their sins. Thank you very much.
Honorable Matebula, Honorable Tring. Honorable Tring.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I had myself muted. Chair, just firstly, thank you for the presentations, and I think certainly a large amount of concerns, and much of the concerns that I've had have also been echoed by colleagues who have actually spoken before me. Hopefully, I will not repeat much of what they have said, but there may be some repetition. Chair, just in terms of slide six of the presentation, the inability to reach 2%, the 2% target, presumably due to lack of suitably qualified applicants is unacceptable. You know, this is with regards to those with disabilities. And the department can't reach that 2% target, creating employment for those with disabilities. And I think that this, in essence, speaks to and is indicative of just the challenges that the department has and the inability that the department has to actually meet other targets in other programs. It is also unacceptable that we have an underspending. To the tune on slide 18 of just in this particular sector of some 113 million unspent in goods and services. This under-expenditure, as my previous colleagues have indicated, is unacceptable, particularly with regards to the high level of unemployment that we have in the country. This level of unemployment is set to increase to some 40%. And so with the high level of unemployment, the high level of inequality that we see in South Africa, poverty that we see in South Africa, we have our own that are doing a disservice to South Africans. And I think clearly it cannot be accepted as, you know, something that is now becoming normal. We cannot normalize this under expenditure. The irregular expenditure of some 197 million rand also underscores the challenges that we have within the department, and it must raise, particularly in the current adverse economic climate that we face. You know, irregular expenditure. This speaks to not complying with your supply chain management contracts, not complying with your MFM, your finance management legislation that is there, and clearly, Chair, I think that this is where accountability, consequence management must be applied. We cannot year in and year out have similar findings of fruitless, wasteful, irregular expenditure, and very little, if any, consequence management. I think that the fact that PMTE has regressed from a qualified opinion to a disclaimer must raise serious red flags. And again, I think it's the Honourable Hicklin who asked the question, can PMTE be considered a going concern? And I think that if one looks at the trajectory, I think clearly there are a number of red flags with regards to that particular trajectory. It was mentioned that your client departments prioritize private leases, and when budget cuts are implemented, payments to PMTE are the first to go. I think that this particular scenario is one that we currently are seeing at Telkom Towers. In Telkom Towers, there is some 31 million rand or 272 million or so per annum that is paid by the department on behalf of the police department on those private leases. So here is an indication. And we have property that is there, but it's not being utilized. And for the reasons that we all know. And so clearly, this is something that has to be dealt with, and it's got to stop. The Office of the AG also indicated that in terms of the target set for maintaining buildings, only 5% of the portfolio, 5% of the property portfolio would probably only be reached. Chair, and so with regards to proactive and reactive maintenance, currently we are seeing reactive maintenance, and the Auditor General, Office of the Auditor General says what needs to happen is that a plan must be put in place. And so, Chair, I'm asking that we see and we call for this plan of proactive maintenance to be put in place And this particular committee monitors that particular plan that the minister needs to put in place to ensure that there is proactive maintenance of all of the properties. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Tring. My comments and questions will be focused on PMTE, as my colleagues have, I think, dealt with the department on many issues. But what I can further emphasize on, the issue of the employment of foreign nationals for positions of administrative, that can't be on. I think we all know that South Africa is one of the countries that have high unemployment rate. We have young people, graduates that are loitering the streets, that are looking for work. And we are told here that there are foreign nationals that have been employed for administration when we have so many people. That one we cannot agree upon. I support 100% all my colleagues who are saying that, why are you employing foreign nationals for positions of administration? Because that is not a skill that you can say it's a technical skill or a skill that is needed when you have so many unemployed graduates out there. So on that one, we really need answers. We cannot agree on that one. On the issue of PMTE, one of the reasons AG has raised it gave a disclaimer opinion on the audit opinion on PMTE is the issue of restating of the asset register. I really don't understand why there was a need of restating an asset register to be different from what it was audited on the 2020-2021. What is being hidden there? Why there was such a major change? And now you are sitting with a disclaimer audit opinion because you have restated the asset register. There are also red flags there. There are also serious red flags on that one. Two, the issue of the vacancies. I want to put it the way that you have written there. The issue of so many vacancies in PMTE, some resignations. What is this thing? Oh God. And some resignations. Yeah. The vacancy rate on the PMTE of 646 personnel, of which 317 fall under Program 6, that is Facilities Management Services. The question is, what is the impact that these vacancies have on PMTE delivering its mandate? Two, again, you are also indicating that there are 493 staff additional to the establishment of PMTE. Can you please clarify what does that mean in terms of the staff establishment when we have additional on the establishment of PMTE? Can you please explain that? There is something that that said there. 67 people have retired, and as such, an amount of 8.9 million. Was reported for retirement awards, which is an increase of 7.9 million if you look at 2020-2021 when 111 employees retired. 67 retired, 8.9, 111 retired that year. 1 million was spent on the retirement awards. Can you please clarify those things? Okay, for now, I'll stop there. Over to you. DM, DJ, and your team.
And thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and a good afternoon to your good self and the honorable members. My apologies for the few minutes delay in connecting, which I experienced earlier. It is a confusion of the links that were sent to me. I've been waiting on a link for tomorrow's meeting, and that delayed me a little bit, but I was able to realize that when it was 28 minutes past and I was not admitted to the meeting. So my apology to quickly check what's happening. That being said, honorable members and honorable chairperson, my approach of allowing officials to first go into the areas which have been asked, I will come back on the summary of the issues, especially those that would really be reflecting on our oversight function in the department. I will allow the acting DG who is on the platform to share with his colleagues what would be the responses, and I will round up at the end. With your permission, Chair, I will hand over to the acting DG, Dr. Moemi.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And thanks to the Deputy Minister and to the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Chairperson, my apologies. I request that I remain with the camera off. The bandwidth in the office is not okay. I've been kicked out several times on the platform. If the Chair agrees, it will indulge me to proceed as such. Chairperson, I wish to respond to some of the clarity-seeking questions that have been raised by the committee. But first, to acknowledge the instructive directives that the committee places before us and indicates that we, the direction we need to take and to follow in that regard, and we welcome those. We don't think that we should contest those or even say anything to it other than to confirm to the committee that they are well received and that we will proceed with them in terms of implementation. We have listened carefully to some of the key issues that have been brought to the fore and how the committee would want us to deal with this. We welcome such measures as the production of a comprehensive proactive maintenance plan and to table it before the committee, which can then track and hold us accountable to that. We have had the strong issue pertaining to the filling of vacancies. We have listened succinctly to the need to proceed with that without any further ado. What we would wish to respond to are some of the clarity-seeking questions and the questions that the committee members have asked as to the rationale for what we have put forth. let me indicate that, yes, indeed, we have a high staff turnover relative to the norm, because we are quite cognizant that we are a department that is quite among the largest departments in government. We have a number of staff members across regions as well as at head office. And we also have done an age analysis on the staff complement we have. And we have also looked at the staffing adequacy exercise, particularly of the PMTE. We are also cognizant of the fact that a large portion of our members are at the end of their contractual obligations to us, and equally some of them at the retirement age. And with the aged staff members, as it is by normal attrition, we'll also see a number of employees leave the service and the department in this regard. The key issue, yes, becomes what do we do about that? We have been asked, what do we do to retain skills? We are allowed to extend, in some instances, staff members who are supposed to retire at 60, to extend them to retire at 65. Where appropriate, this has been determined, and such staff members have been retained. But typically, even for cases of early retirement where it has been granted, each case has been dealt with on its own merits, and having duly considered all factors and having looked on a unit by unit basis in this regard, in terms of the shortage of skills. What we cannot put aside is the fact that we ought to then fill the vacancies with speed. And I'm sure that members are aware that right now in the pipeline, in terms of the different stages of recruitment process that we are undertaking, there is no less than 250 positions in stream. So, and at different tiers and levels of recruitment in this regard. And I think that what we should do is to put focus to fast-tracking this process and to making sure that more capacity for recruitment is actually enhanced. And I think that that part has been done. We have prioritized those positions in HR, particularly in the area of recruitment, and we are looking at fast-tracking this process within this context. There has been the issue related here to as to why last year when we fewer staff members retired, when higher staff members retired, we paid lesser retirement awards, and why comparatively this year it appears fewer are retiring, but it appears we have an increase in terms of the awards. Well, two reasons really. Number one, Honorable Chair, is attributable to the fact that the rules of the VPS and the pension award, and they are linking to inflation and to all of that, determine the payout on the basis of the last salary notch of an employee, and also on the basis of the pertaining economic conditions at the time and the set rules upon exit as at that time. And so when the GEPS board approves, as well as the council, and as confirmed by the president, DPSA approves higher percentages for awards in this regard, we will certainly see an increase in that area. The second part of it is that the awards really, as I've indicated, are predetermined and packed on the basis of what notch and what salary level you are on. So if in any given year you've got more people on higher salary bands retiring, your awards are likely to be more higher as compared to if most employees on a lower salary band were to retire. And I think taking those two factors into account and knowing that this is one of the areas which we, the department, can only but compile, but the confirmation of the exact awards are not determined here, but they are determined by GPS and the National Treasury. we can certainly say that we have a higher degree of certainty that the awards paid are correct ones. So with that in mind, I think that should provide a response for the clarity that the chair sought on in as far as that matter is concerned. Honorable Graham Murray had raised the matter of the two employees at the level 16 and who did not have a performance agreement in place. She wanted to know who are these two employees and the rationale as to why they are not having performance agreement. The two employees are from the reason why he could not conclude the performance agreement was that he was at suspension. And here the report is taken as at 31st of March 2022. And the second employee is Alec Muemi, who at the time, as at 31st March 2022, had not signed the performance agreement as had PMT, but had signed one in the capacity of acting DG. So I think that accounts for the two employees at level 16 and why there was such a discrepancy in this regard. In as far as the issue that has been raised around foreign professionals, we should at the outset indicate that we comply fully with the law, and we, in as far as the appointment of foreign professionals are concerned, and we also follow strictly the conditions in the Immigration Act as well as other policies of government relative hereto. And I think the point to be made in this regard is that we are also signatories to protocols and cooperation agreements with some countries by which we also exchange professionals and we also host visiting professionals in this regard, and as part of the exchange program and as part of the administrative support programs that we sign on a country-to-country level basis, and which will account for this. In some instances, the host country has to pay, and in some instances, the forwarding country pays. So it's a mixed bag in as far as that is concerned, but we need to indicate that we do not have any employees from foreign who have come in on a basis that they do not qualify by the rules and the law and the policies that are in place. And in effect, even to this extent, no such finding is being made by the AG nor any of the Chapter 9 institutions, including the one relevant here being the Public Service Commission. However, we do hear and take to heart the issue about this. The question was, what are we doing to get the locals into space? I think with our HCI program, we are clear that all foreign employees have got to transfer skills as part of the actual program. And we also have a young professionals program by which we recruit graduates in the built environment, and we place them under the tutelage of these foreign professionals to transfer the relative skills over a period. And you may have seen that even with our mentorship program and the formal mentors we appoint to oversee this, we also do a skills transfer test to the locals and to the youngsters to see whether indeed by the time the agreements that are in place that are transferred to locals so that there is continuity, and we also can have locals that have acquired this critical and scarce skills. In as far as the issue of the understanding CPM budget, that has been raised this thing for some time, and over a number of years it has been repeated correctly. Honorable Hickling is asking, what exactly are we doing? How do you resolve this matter? And that they frown upon the reasons provided in this regard, that contractors do delay. And the question is, if that is the case, what have you done about those defaulting contractors, and are they still on the books of the department? Now, I need to say that we follow strictly the JB. Provisions in terms of the resolution of disputes with contractors, penalties as provided for in this contract, and I'm sure that you may have seen that those disputes at hand and our refusal to pay them unless they have done remedial completion of projects. It is a right thing, consequences on our part, and there is where we are repeated failures. And this has also had an effect of delaying the completion of projects because our procurement process had been taking time to get replacement contractors. We have now analyzed this problem quite clearly. We have agreed on the institutionalization of a panel of contractors, which will allow us to have an ease of change of contractors when they do default. And so, yes, the answer is yes, we are taking actions. We are following the provisions of the dispute resolution mechanisms as laid down in the standardized construction contract. And we are hammering them hard in terms of penalties and also with recovery. They also lose their deposits in other instances. And so, yes, however, each matter is dealt with on its own merits on a case-by-case basis. But the principle is exactly as Honorable Graham Mare asked, whether we are indeed acting against these contractors. Yes, we are. Some of them, yes, they are still on our books. The onus to remove them is with the Treasury. The real test on our part is whether we have reported such defaulting contractors to the Treasury. And the answer is yes. In fact, on a quarterly basis, we do submit the status of this and what we are doing about each and every one of them. We have also began compiling a report for our minister on significantly delayed projects, and we are reporting on what interventions and what measures we're taking in this regard in as far as that is concerned. There has been a question about the cost of employment and why it is this high, and why are we not we are underspending in this area. Like I have indicated, Honorable Chair, in this regard, I don't think that we need to dilly-dally about it. We must accept full responsibility to simply drive and to enhance the mechanisms we have already put in place to fill these vacancies. As I've indicated, there's over 250 positions now in stream at different stages of recruitment, and even in the coming 2 weeks, we'll still be advertising even more positions. We are keen on getting on with it and on getting everybody in stream. And I think for the first time, Chair will also see that some of the positions we are beginning to advertise and to fill are those in anticipation of the exit of personnel who are coming out, and those who have indicated already ahead of time that they will be retiring, and that such analysis has linked the recruitment process to such exit indications that have been received. We do accept, Honorable Hicklin points out that the accounting officer has a responsibility to report on all the under-collection of revenue. I need to indicate that indeed, and we wish to confirm that the annual report does indicate such a report, and we are also obligated to report to the Treasury on a quarterly basis, and we can confirm that such reports have also been issued to the Treasury, in which clearly we do indicate the lack of collection of all revenue due to the account of the PMTE and the challenges that have been there. I can indicate that we have had renewed efforts at recollection, and we had begun engaging with the default in departments even much more vigorous. Instances which have immediately yielded fruits, but we have seen some green fruits in as far as that is concerned. And we are even much more robustly because we don't believe that they are setting a good example if they are part of the departments that are not necessarily honoring their obligations to us, and that in full. The chair has raised the matter of restating of assets in the register and restating the opening and closing balances. And as to why we found it necessary to temper, chair said that in her opinion, this borders on perhaps even corrupt practices, and that this shouldn't be allowed and shouldn't be done. Truth be told is that, yes, indeed, the opening and closing balances from an accounting point of view are a sacrosanct principle that shouldn't be tampered with. Your closing balance should always be your opening balance. There's no doubt about that. That is an established principle that is also established in GRAP in this regard. But we have a dilemma, Chair, because we are daily, as we comb through all the books, we check the deed records, we check all the land, state land community records, and we do comparisons and we do recover from time to time some properties. We do realize that some properties were wrongly vested. They need to be vested in our national register, and we do so. As we do, clearly, Chair, is that and those values, as they come into stream. And as we have not necessarily managed to do this well because of the transition since 1994 from the old apartheid, then the issue of the land in truth was never handled the way it should have. And it led to a lot of confusion with the three spheres of government, and more so the us and provinces. And even with the self-governing territories, as well as the land belonging to the former TBVC states, this has been a thorny issue of vesting and ownership, and which we believe that with us, because only we, the Department of Public Works, must drive that process vigorously and make sure that once and for all, either way, that the determinations that should have been made in 1994 are made for once and for all. So as long as it remains in this way and there is lack of clarity, I can tell you that once in a while we come across new processes. There were even properties that were expropriated by the state, but they were never really vested and they were never taken to their logical conclusion. And across the way, we do meet up with properties that belong to us. And when these properties should have been stated in previous years and they were never, it will also be very wrong on our part not to include those properties nor their values, and to correct what essentially would mean that then the values we closed up with were actually wrong values, and which means that they would need to be changed. So the AG had said, no, you guys have changed your values so much that they had become so material to the actual overall value of your register that we don't even know where to start to audit you on this thing, and hence the disclaimer opinion. We have to find each other with the AG on this matter as to how, because this is still going to be forthcoming. We're not going to close the register now and abandon it so that we reject all other assets we have to discover. As we have engaged the SIU, and as the SIU is going after crocodiles and getting all the assets that were stolen from the state and surreptitiously registered in private people's names and wrongly vested and so on, as we recover those assets and they return back to the state, they will certainly change the value of our asset thing. And this cannot be considered as new acquisitions, because if there were new acquisitions, we simply top up and we do not necessarily change the previous closing balances. But in this regard, these are assets that should have always been stated as assets of the state. And from a GRAP point of view and an accounting point of view, we must find a solution because we can't reject those and say the figures are now sacrosanct and we will not tamper with them. So I think we have that dilemma. We do not dispute what the AG say, that we have tampered with the closing and opening balances. Yes, indeed, that has happened. The question is, we even said to the AG, please give us your advice as a value add on how best to treat this matter, because we should have a single asset register. We will not attach them to a separate register. And I think that we will have to find ultimately an accounting solution, and hence we are engaging accounting firms to also advise us on how best to deal with this matter. We will continue, though, with the investigation of the assets. We are aware that the deeds registry, there are assets that we should work on and that we should ultimately bring into our stream and into our register. And we would not want to see a repeat of us tampering with the opening and closing balances willy-nilly, as it may. Then there was the issue of why ESA is not reporting, that PMTE is reporting separately, and that DPWI is also reporting separately. PMTE itself is a trading entity in terms of Regulation 19. So it's a trading entity of the department, and no wonder it is able to get its own separate vote. And that's why, because the rules of accounting to Parliament, in terms of the rules of Parliament, is that each vote must have its own separate books, and that it must be accounted for individually with its own books. However, ESA is a government component. It's on its way to becoming an entity. It's not an entity yet. And so its allocation, although we do indicate it in the score item of our budget, so that we can clearly see what it is for, but by law and by the rules of Parliament, we are not required to prepare separate books for it, primarily because it has no separate vote. And accordingly, its expenditure, and that is accounted for within the books of the department. And it is within that context that there are no separate books to report on for ESA as a separate entity. On the issue of EPWP, I would request the CFO to respond to that as to which contractor was this and whether this contractor is still on the platform for that to be accounted for, as well as on the issue of the 30-day payments and the late payment by the PMTE. Chair, let me pause there. And
Acting DG. Chair, can I proceed? Mandla Stoley.
Yes, Mandla, please.
Thank you, Chair. There was also a question on the bank overdraft and unauthorized expenditure. I must indicate this is an unauthorized expenditure that is coming over the years since I think 2014. There was an investigation that was done. We have submitted to National Treasury for them to take the matter to Parliament to approve that unauthorized expenditure. So as a result of that, it creates a bank overdraft because it consumed our bank. So that's where we are on that. There was also a question, what are we doing about number of properties where we are not generating revenue? We have engaged Treasury on that. There is a program that is called itemized billing. That program is intended for us to charge government department a tariff structure that will assist the department to be self-sustainable financially. But at this stage, government is not affording the tariff structure that we are charging, which then Treasury is unable to approve what is expected, even though in terms of the model that we are using, Treasury has approved that model in principle. However, they are not approving the tariff structure as we want. So when questions are asked whether PMTE is self-sustainable or not, the source of revenue for PMTE is a government department. As we indicated earlier on, 97% of our portfolio is utilized by a government department. So if we don't generate enough revenue from the asset portfolio that we have, and clients are also not paying, then it raises that question of the going concern for PMTE. The other thing that relates to us was the issue of finance, the issue of 30 days payments. Chair, normally AG will put a non-compliance in the audit reports. For the past 2 years, both PMT and DPW, there was no such a paragraph. However, there are instances where certain invoices, in significant number of invoices, are not paid within 30 days, which maybe the member was relating to that. As a result, the overall performance on 30 days were at 89% for PMTE. Looking at 162,000 invoices that we processed, 89% of those invoices were paid within 30 days. And when we closed the year end, we only had 19 invoices that were not paid outside 30 days. So there is a lot of effort that is being done in that area. However, there are instances where if we have not paid invoices, there might be challenges of dispute with service providers where we need to go on site or on site and verify if the work is done. That's where that small number is coming from. I'm not sure if I have missed another key. Okay, the other key question was the issue of a contractor that did not provide a PPE. If Aaron can comment on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. We will try and get the name of the service provider, because the money that was underspent is on the side of the department, but the appointment, it is being done by IDT for the non-state sector program. I'm not sure if colleagues from EPWP, they know the service provider. If they know, they do, then they can assist. If not, then we'll provide the information later.
Acting PG, if I can come in, Honorable Chair, and members of the committee, this is Ignatius Sario from EPWP. I just want to respond a little bit on the EPWP question. The issue of the IDT, the money had been transferred for PPE, but was not paid to any service provider because there was delays in procurement. But my colleagues, Paulo Kwagomzera, will give a little bit of detail. They had challenges with procurement, so the money was not spent. The other one, in terms of the 1.5 million that was not transferred, that was not to a service provider, but Gauteng Department of Sports, Arts and Culture. We did not pay their second and third tranche on the EPWP integrated grant because they were not complying with the conditions of the Division of Revenue Act in terms of reporting on projects and expenditure, because we had transferred the first tranche to them on the account of the business plan they had submitted to us, an agreement and project list, but they are supposed to then report on the projects and expenditure. And when we engaged with them, they said they had delays in implementation of their projects. But Chair, if you can just allow me to allow my colleague, Ms. Paulo Kwagomgera, who deals with the non-state sector, if she can just add a little on the PPE. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and the members of the Portfolio Committee and DM and the colleagues. I think you have responded to the question, Acting DDG, adequately, in my view, because the service provider was going to be appointed by IDT to provide the PPEs. But then because they did not manage, you know, to reflect accordingly, the PPEs and the quality that was required of the PPEs, then the service provider was not finally appointed to do this part of the procurement and service delivery. So then the money was not paid to the service provider. The question that was raised, or the point that is raised by Mazibuko Aaron, to say if we know the name of the service provider, it is the one that would provide the name. But be it as it may, I think at this point we are clear that the service provider was not paid that amount of 64.3 million. Thank you, Chair.
Are we through with all the responses, or DM, or you want to come in? Honorable Graham Murray had indicated that she would like to have a second bite.
Okay, no, I wanted to just round off the issues, Chair. Because there are those matters that are consistent from all the honorable members, which reflect on the seriousness with which the committee views the matter. And I wanted to just round off all around those and indicate to the members of the committee that actually as a committee, I mean, as the ministry, when we approve, we took an approach that says, when we approve an acting capacity, that is when a vacancy arises, as we approve that acting capacity, our HR must attach the plan to fill in that vacancy, so that we stop this acting perpetually. It's part of the culture change issues, because it has been a trend, or it has been as if it's normal that a person must act for years before recruitment takes place. And we emphasize the point with our HR unit to say, once a vacancy is created, that is immediately when one leaves, as you appoint, or as the responsible unit recommends the person to be appointed, with that, HR must then attach a plan that says, by this date, we shall have advertised. By this date, we shall have shortlisted. By this date, we shall have had interviews. And by this date, we shall have... That's the only way now to kind of push through the issue of recruitment. We would have so much vacancies in against what is out there. We have currently, for example, in PMTE, as at September, when I checked the quarterly report, we are at 4,500 plus employees. And the vacancies that are there are 400 odd, which means we're around 10%. And we don't need that 10%, truth be told. But generally, the norms are around, I think, 12%, that which is acceptable in terms of the norms and standards. But even that, to us, because the quota or the workforce is huge, the numbers, therefore, also look huge, even though if you work percentage-wise, they are not we are not way off what would be normal elsewhere. But because of the numbers, again, I do want to emphasize the point that we understand the comments and the criticism from the honorable members that it would be influenced by those high numbers. I think the question of ESA has been adequately clarified. On the recommendations that are never acted upon, we may say that, but if the honorable members were to be privy in our internal audit meetings with the audit committee and the internal auditors, you would understand that the part of the recommendations from the work of members constitute that internal audit report. And therefore, on a quarterly basis, we do meet to assess how far we are, and our internal audit unit does assist us with this. But as we understand, a huge department like this, you would be making the desired decisions and actions. But at times, because of the huge of the size of the department, you may realize that the impact is not that quickly realized. But we are not deterred from ensuring that the recommendations from the portfolio committee, from the Public Service Commission, in fact, some of the audit outcomes are as a result of our actions on reports from such bodies as the Public Service Commission. You would understand that the one report that has been quite impactful is the number of people who were employed unprocedurally, whose then their salaries, because they were not properly employed, their salaries become unauthorized expenditure. But we can't not pay them whilst they are in the employ until such time that their cases are resolved. And those cases are some of the DC that we are dealing with, some are with the courts, the labor court, which limits our ability to say we take a decision to dismiss, for example, until the court case has been resolved. So I felt I needed just to put some of the handicaps into context. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We may do the take the follow-up. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, DM. The follow-up questions, honorable members.
I know Honorable Graham Murray had indicated. Honorable Matebula's hand is also up. It's only those two hands that I can see now. Honorable Graham Murray, followed by Honorable Matebula.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the responses received so far. I'm going to now limit my input to PNTE. And again, it's based on both the presentation done today as well as the financials. So one of the first things I want to raise is, and this was touched on, are the contingent liabilities of 13.337 million. When the presentation was given, we were advised that this was as a result of labor costs arising out of the bargaining council. But my understanding is that only 3 million of that is out of the bargaining council, and the other 10 arises from a defamation case against the minister. So if you could just clarify that, please. And then I want to come to the point that everybody's made, is that with about the PNT not being a going concern. My understanding is that, my dogs have just barked. My understanding now is that the PNT has not yet been fully operationalized in terms of what the requirements are from National Treasury. So if we could please get clarification on when that is going to happen. And in order for that to happen, it has to be a going concern. There's no ways that you can operationalize something that's running at such a massive loss. And let me tell you that based on what we've seen today, with a 1.02 billion rand overdraft, we've got assets that exceed the liabilities by 6.7 billion rand, a major deficit in terms of the financials for the year. This is an organization that spent 101 million rand on consultants for OPEX work. In other words, for operational expenditure. This is stuff that could be done in-house if they had the right people appointed and if the people had the requisite skills. And again, that goes back to the vacancies. And while the deputy minister is saying, well, it's not a big deal, at the end of the day, I think we would pay a lot less for in-house people to do the work that we're paying consultants to do. And I'm not talking about the capital expenditure when we're running projects. I'm talking about day-to-day stuff that, you know, investigations into over expenditure. And a consultant has been appointed for that. I don't understand why we don't have forensic people within the department that can do the same thing. And I'm telling you now, it would cost a lot less than 101 million rand. We've had 33.5 million rand lost on the operational expenditure due to unfunded portions of projects that have failed. We've got 303,896,000 rand in legal claims against the PMTE on property and maintenance disputes. We've only got 107 million rand on contingent assets. In other words, that's claims that we are laying. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure was 106.45 million. 5 million rand of that was costs incurred due to inefficiencies. 27.6 million was extensions of time. 13.5 million rand was discrepancies on extensions of time. These are costs that we can be saving if we're doing the job properly. In terms of the funding of the PMTE, the bulk of the funding comes from, yes, from properties that are being leased, but also from transfers from the department, as well as another 1.5 billion rand augmentation. But over and above all of that, the number of shared costs that exist between the department and the PMTE are massive. All the corporate services are actually provided by the department to the PMTE. And there's no value attached to that in fact, they say in the financials, they can't attach a value to that. In other words, you're talking about operationalizing an entity that actually is not self-sustaining, that is not a going concern. And I agree with my colleagues when they say that this needs business rescue. Then we've got things like costs regarding arts and culture and justice that haven't been recovered, where the department has paid, or PMT has paid, for gardening services and cleaning services to the tune of 265 million rand, and they've received 13.4 million rand in exchange for the services that they've covered. That's untenable. You can't be providing that amount of services. That's like a 200%. You know, difference in terms of what you're spending versus what you're getting, what you're recovering. Again, we're spending half of what we spend on leases, we're spending on maintenance of our own properties, which is just a massive issue. And then obviously in terms of the debtor's age analysis, we've now got an 8 billion rand opening balance for the new financial year, 3 billion up on the previous year. So an 82% recovery of debtors is just, it's untenable because it's just creating a bigger opening balance for us for next year. So in terms of the PMTE, these are some of the big issues that we need to look at. And then just finally with respect to ESA, I understand that ESA hasn't, we haven't got an entity for it. But 122 million rand has been spent. This is an arm of the department. It's the infrastructure arm of DPWI. It is responsible for 100 billion rands worth of infrastructure over the next 10 years that it needs to be facilitating and coordinating. And we can't do oversight over it because there's no separate reporting, even though it's a separate arm, it's got its own organogram, and we're not being given any insight into how the money has been utilized for that. I find that deeply concerning. Thank you very much for the second opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Honorable Matebula, followed by Honorable Van Skalvig. Honorable Matebula?
I think this was a legacy hand, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Honorable. Honorable Van Skalvig.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I want to echo the same sentiment that Honorable Kramer raised in terms of the outstanding debt and the age analysis of those debt. And we've seen several interventions that has been made, and still we remain on 8 billion rand. So we really need to find alternative measures in terms of recovering those debt and follow up on the interventions through treasury that has been made. I think that can assist also in terms of recovering that debt or minimizing it in future. Then, Chairperson, I think we need a full report, maybe a separate meeting with regards to service providers, especially the top 10 service providers in terms of leases and in terms of maintenance, especially the unscheduled maintenance, but also in terms of consultants, because we really need some clarification also on how many consultants are being used and the cost involving that exercise. Then, Chairperson, the very last one, I want to know, Chairperson, are we going to see the draft public works bill being gazetted during our term before 2024? Because I thought that was the priority to our committee, but every year when we receive the annual report and even the quarterly reports, there's no movement on that issue. So can we be taken into confidence on what is the yield up in terms of that issue? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Van Skalvig. Those are the follow-up questions, DM and your team.
Thank you once more, Honorable Chairperson. And allow me to take the same approach. Acting DG will deal with the details and I will come back when rounding off. Thank you. Acting DG, with your permission, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and Honorable Members and Deputy Minister. Chair, I think the comments made by Honorable Graham Mare, they are taken to heart, honestly, and we have listened carefully to concerns in this regard and to the going status of the PMT and on the issue of the financial management of the PMT and the model for cost recovery that she's talking to. I need to, at the outset, indicate that we are also similarly concerned. We have looked at this runaway train in terms of the deficit and the inability to collect, and also what the CFO has outlined, the dependency on the state coffers and state departments, land departments, to service the revenue, and the fact that we have not necessarily been sweating the assets of the state very well, and we have not necessarily had a forward way in as far as that is concerned, and even her earlier comments about the letting out strategy as to why we have not necessarily serviced that, and why we have not exploited that opportunity, and why have we ignored those who came forward with proposals for utilization of our assets for a fee and for rentals and payments and revenue. One needs to indicate that we are discussing this with the Treasury. We have traced the genesis of this to the initial change in the policy and in the allocation of mandate with no resources, but the resources being devolved and the budgets being devolved to client departments in this regard as the beginning of when, and I think from there you would see that after that financial year, the first or the next financial year that follows suit came with an opening balance of the deficit of under collection in this regard, owing to a series of disputes that have since ensued in that. We are discussing with the Treasury the possibility of ring-fencing of the budgets for this purpose, and we have also discussed with, and we have even as ourselves approached the AG to find out, as they audit the other departments, to look at if this money was budgeted for rentals, and which should have been handed over to us, and even for property rates and taxes and every other thing, and yet the departments have not necessarily paid it over to us. What has the department's consent utilized it for? Because the provisions of the law do not allow for budgets appropriated for one purpose to be utilized for other. We aren't saying that client departments must be forced by all costs to pay, even for where they have genuine disputes with us. But however, the issue is that we should endeavor to resolve the disputes as they arise, and for us to clarify issues. We have entered vigorously now. For instance, one of the client departments who have had a long-standing dispute with over many financial years, for which we had been under-collecting, has been the Department of Transport. And we have now looked at what they had been raising, and we have raised the issue of the dispute of whether what they are letting is the same space as what we are levying them for. And the dispute has arose from day one on that, and somehow it has not been resolved. We have now entered into discussions with them. We believe we have found a solution. We have appointed an independent evaluator who has now remeasured the space, and we and Transport have agreed that whichever outcome that goes, both parties will accept that outcome, and then we can generalize the entries and update our books, and where Transport owes us, they will have to make good on what they owe. So these models and these interventions we're making in earnest to resolve the long-standing disputes, to address the historical balance, but also to have a revised model with the Treasury of ring-fencing the budget so that we can avoid a recurrence in the future of a similar thing is what we are working on. And internally, we are also revising our own policies to make sure that our systems are a bit more robust in resolutions of dispute at an early stages as and when they arise. And I can give an example. For instance, the latest has been Department of Minerals and Energy, which has contested the space allocation at Mineralia. We have not wasted time. We're within 2 weeks of the dispute having arose, we had already sent engineers to go and remeasure the property and to make sure that indeed it is correct. And we have since submitted the new measurements to them, and the measurements had confirmed exactly what we had initially levied them. We believe that with the proof we have now given them, they should be able to accept that their rental is correct and that they must pay it. So as it is, our contention is that yes, we are aware that it may appear that it is a runaway train, but we have to put concerted effort to resolve this and to also ensure that the debt doesn't balloon any further, and that those that have been recurring and ongoing for a long time, that's what we have sought to target first, including, as I responded earlier, a good example being that of the Treasury, where the shortfall is quite huge. It's about 200 million every year, and obviously it has become significant over a number of years since the dispute arose, and we are looking at resolving that. Of course, we are also looking at the issue of sweating the assets. We have discussed with members of the committee several options we have put in this regard to make sure that first, we reduce the cost of doing business, for instance, by greening our buildings and lowering the cost of utilities in this regard. But secondly, we are also looking at the ROT process by which we will have investment by the private sector into refurbishment of our buildings and having better rental stock. And the permutation of the ROT program, currently we are doing it selfishly so that we lower rental costs, but ultimately we will do it also for commercial purposes so we can sweat the assets of the state. And I think the plan is there. We are the first ones to admit that the scenario is unhealthy, Honorable Graham Murray, where we outlay in the region of 5.3 billion rents every year in renting private sector properties, and yet our own efforts at renting out our own government properties to the private sector yields about 80 million a year, which is quite a pittance considering what we are outlaying. We had reported earlier that we are beginning to claw back. We have agreed with the Treasury on an ambitious target of clawing back a billion within one financial year in rental, in leasing in costs. And therefore, we believe that we could be on a right track, and we seek not just to look at increases in meeting our targets, but also in expansion of new leased out properties, and in also in ensuring that we spread and diversify our tenant base in this regard. And I think we are getting there. It may have been quite a premature thing if we had not embedded the standard operating procedures in as far as leasing out. And we found that our Circular 135 had some deficiencies, and it will have opened up to many corrupt practices and to many other challenges had we not tightened it. And now we believe we have done so, even in terms of the approvals for some of these things, and even the setup of the committees that have also independent people on them to make sure that the processes are a bit more robust, so that as and when we lease out, we do not see what we have been seeing as a trend, that government properties are actually being leased out for a pittance compared to market-related costs that we should be fetching on the open market. But we also had to balance this with Section 5 of KIAMA, which compels us to also do to lease out our facilities for the social good and for development purposes and not necessarily commercial. And these two, we have now embedded the rules and processes pertaining to these two parallel streams of letting out of our properties. And to this extent, I believe that we would then going forward be able to start realizing even better revenue and in also mitigating the losses that we have. On the issue of ESA, really, we aren't refusing to account at all. I think the issue is the manner of accounting, because currently it isn't that we are not accounting for the expenditure of ESA. We are accounting for it, albeit in the books of the department and not as separate standard books. And I think this is what I have been explaining of the vagaries of the process. But in no way can we ever say no if the portfolio committee requires of us to package information in such a manner that it becomes user-friendly for the committee. And if the committee requires us to package expenditure report purely for ESA-related matters, I do not see how we can ever say no. We will be willing and will oblige to do so. There's nothing to hide really about that. And I was just explaining that for purposes of reports like this, of this nature, we are required to account to Parliament and to table reports on a vote-by-vote basis, and that I was only indicating the weakness of the process that there is no vote for ESA, and therefore we could not potentially have tabled a separate independent report. But that does not mean by any means that we are reluctant or recalcitrant in as far as provision of a report that is dedicated to ESA. I think we would be willing to oblige to do so. On the issue of looking at the key cost drivers and what Honorable Van Schalkwyk raises, we have done an assessment of the top 10 of the service providers that are providing us with leases. And this has been a subject of our target, actually, in negotiating better prices and so on, because among these top 10 landlords, they account for a significant portion, in excess of 50% of what we are doing countrywide in as far as leasing in. And therefore, a dent is made immediately when you reach better agreements with these landlords. And I think even the result of the landlord conference and our embedding of the Ruud report as a benchmark for the market does prove and attest to the point that I'm making. And I think Honorable Van Schalkwyk is on the money in as far as what she propounds to be a way forward in terms of our strategies that we can employ and engage with. And also, even in this regard, we are now, having seen the successes with leases, we are applying same for processes of the top 10 contractors in the construction area, and to ensure that if we troubleshoot on those, we see better expenditure, better movement of this, but also of import, a completion of projects on time, within budget, and also to make sure that the impact on service delivery is much more better. I will pause there, Chair, with your permission, and hand over to the DM. Thank you.
Now, thank you, Acting DG. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think, again, the Acting DG has covered quite some ground in explaining the areas that the Honorable Members have raised. Mine is to really look at to indicate Honorable Chair to Honorable Graham Murray that there would be nothing one would underplay when you are charged with the responsibility to ensure good governance. The question of dealing with the high unemployment rate is one that really is a matter of concern to all of us. And as people delegated to oversee the what happens in the department, they will, as officials also indicate, our displeasure when we deal, how we share our displeasure when we deal with this matter of vacancies. And therefore, I really wouldn't underplay anything, but I was just trying to illustrate. In fact, the issue that, the example that I made is an example that shows that we wouldn't want to see vacancies prolonged. We would want to see vacancies filled in timelessly. And therefore, we can't underplay a matter of national importance such as this one, unless we are truly irresponsible leaders. My second point would be on, I think that again, Acting DG has covered me on Honorable Van Stalkwyk's request. I think we can quickly do this because exactly the example that the Acting DG has made around the property ones, and having engaged and having realized some results out of the engagements that we've held with the landlords that we rent from, and therefore I won't bedevil that point. Safe to say that those top tens, both of the consultants, the property landlords, and the construction companies that receive much from the department or are the top 10 ones, I think it would be easy to provide that information because it should be easy to compile. One last point from my side is on the why not have specialized personnel for areas such as forensics and all that. And these are the discussions and the approaches that we are employing in the department to ensure that the desired skills, the requisite skills, we do have. The GRC branch becomes the branch that is responsible, especially for areas of investigations, forensics, and all that. But we are of the view also at times when you have, let me say, we need to look at each case on its merits. Because again, when you have people like investigators in-house, with time, you would find that they then become subsumed in the culture of the organization, or they become so much part of the furniture that objectivity on matters of this nature escape them as human beings. Now, you at times do need to get a view, an objective view from outside, and therefore have somebody from outside looking inside. And therefore the department does need to strike a balance between the two. There would be those cases that really you don't have to go outside and spend a lot. You need the skill in-house. But there would be instances where you need to get an objective view looking into the organization from outside. And therefore, a balance is then necessary for such. I thought that that would have been just an addition on what Acting DG has already responded to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, DM, Acting DG, and your teams on the response of the follow-up questions. Also appreciating the response that you made earlier on. As you all know that we are preparing for the BRRR, all this information is assisting us as we prepare our reports, both as the portfolio committee and as individual members for the debate that will be in the House. Honorable members, as it has indicated on the program that our meeting for today will end at 1600. The time now is 1601. So I think we were within the time that we set for ourselves. Thank you again, honorable members, for your probing questions, for your progressive discussions that are definitely ensuring that this department is taken somewhere and playing our roles, that of ensuring that we do oversight on the executive and the department, that is Department of Public Works and Infrastructure at this time. Tomorrow we are also having another meeting, and on Thursday we are also having another meeting. So I'm hoping that tomorrow you'll be fine in terms of the connectivity. I know that there are people that are experiencing network challenges. I'm also one of those people. When the acting DG was responding, I was in and out of the meeting. Even if I was in, there would be no sound on my side. So I didn't hear some of the responses, but I know that if members heard of the responses, and also there is a recording that is being done by our team, it's good and fine. Thank you again, honorable members, DM, acting DG, and your team. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.